and Chris, and this is my Writing Table podcast, where we talk to authors and other creatives about the writing world and what it takes to create the books that we love to read. Ready? Pull up a chair and let's begin. Hoover is from Harrisburg, Pennsylvania, and she's the author of two poetry collections. Barn Burner won the Anti-Venom Poetry Award and a Florida Book Award. Her poems have appeared in the Best American Poetry and in journals such as Cincinnati Review, Poetry Northwest, Shenandoah, and The Sun. Hoover lives in Tennessee and teaches creative writing at Tennessee Tech University. She curates and hosts a poetry reading series, Sawmill Poetry, and produces the Not Abandon, But Abide monthly interview series for the Southern Review of Books. Her most recent collection of poems can be found in her second book, No Spare People. Welcome, Erin.
Thanks, Chris.
Poetry is introduced to most, if not all of us, as children in nursery rhymes and then later in songs. What was it about poetry that stuck with you and made you want to make a life out of it?
I think about that because I have a daughter. She's six. And I read a lot of her books, you know, to her, and they are really poetic. There's such attention to language in children's books, I've noticed. As a young person, I was doing that kind of reading too, as you mentioned. I was interested in the arts as a young person in general, played the violin. I used to draw. I was a pretty talented artist in visual art. But when I started writing poetry, which I just started as an assignment, my teacher gave me an assignment, like she gave everyone else, to write a poem. And the first time I did that, it was something special to me. I got really excited about it. I got excited about putting words together and really kind of writing a story, but in a way that was aesthetically interesting to me. I'd told stories before, you know, verbally and even written, but not in the form of a poem before. In high school and college, I would write poems and fold them up and put them in my pocket. And I felt like almost like powerful having done that. I had this secret superpower where I was like carrying a poem I wrote and I was proud of it, you know, and I could take it with me. There was no feeling like it. I kept chasing it.
One way to get better at writing fiction is to practice writing poetry, because poetry is boiling it down to the least common denominator, the most powerful words.
There's the act of writing and act of putting it together. But for me, it's also almost like a way of thinking. So some of the things I write about, which I guess I would call like maybe existential things, like how to be a good person, how to be a good mom, what it's like raising a young kid, what it's like living now in a kind of fractured time. Poetry is where I'm able to really think about that. I think to me, actually writing down like almost like an argument, like an essay, like argument, or writing down a linear kind of plot-driven story is what baffles me. I find that harder to do. I think that the way I think is probably in phrases, in particular images, with lineation. It makes you really pay attention to the sentence also. It's almost like you have, if you think of a score where there's all these different instruments playing, with poetry, you have some of the things you have with prose writing, but you've added an additional instrument, which is the ability to break things into lines and stanzas. So to me, that's like, you know, that's extra. And it's sort of become how I think anyway.
Part of the beauty of poetry is we all see it differently. But you can do things with poetry that you can't do with prose.
I told my poetry students that I thought they should take a fiction class because I think some of them need to focus more on writing sentences. Let's learn some sentence syntax here, which is not particularly my specialty, but it's something I think about in contrast to lineation or moving with or against it. I think that's what I love about poetry, honestly, is doing that.
Your most recent collection has an intriguing title, No Spare People.
So this is my second book. My first book was called Barn Burner, and I wrote that before I had my daughter. I also wrote that primarily before 2016. I used to think of September 11th and 2001 as a big important date for America. And now I almost think like 2016 is this weird divider line for me, yep, where there was this world before 2016 and now there's this world after 2016. So Barn Burner is my before book and No Spare People is the after book, which in some ways is me coming to terms with the world we're in now. It's also me doing that with a young child. That kind of made me optimistic. People told me when I had a kid, you know, you have to be an optimist in some ways to have a child. And I found that to be true. The book is really positive, whereas the pre-2016 book, Barn Burner, was very like angry and negative and wanting to fix all these things that were wrong. And it's like, this book is like almost like acknowledging that the world is not perfect and there are things that I wish were different, but I'm going to get through it the best I can. A shift in mindset, maybe. That line, no spare people, it's a reference to my daughter and I. We're a small family of just me, the mom, and her, the daughter. She's a donor-conceived child, so I had her using donor sperm. I have parents, you know, we have extended family, but in terms of the unit, our family, it's just us. And I didn't realize that Prince Harry was going to write that the book called Spare. I was like, oh. I was like, I understand your attraction to the word, though, because I thought a lot about what spare meant, too. But also really, like, all people are essential and all people have something to contribute to our society. Over the last few years, there's been some kind of disturbing rhetoric, especially during COVID, about some people mattering more than other people. Even in the South now, there's some rhetoric about some stories mattering more than others in terms of maybe queer stories not mattering, or maybe the stories of people of color not mattering. And I'm sort of trying to affirm that there are no spare people. You know, I mean, everybody's story is valuable. That's kind of the social justice message of the book. But yet, I mean, basically, it's about a mom and a daughter.
Very you know? Cool. And yeah. What does your daughter think?
About being my inspiration. Well, both of my books are dedicated to her. So the first book, I was pregnant with her and I knew what I was going to name her. So I dedicated it to her. The second book as well. She was very pleased with herself to have two books dedicated to her. Yeah. But she did tell me at one point, she was a little bit younger. She told me that she had written three books and I'd only written two. So she's ahead of me.
It's a competition now, Mom.
Oh my gosh. I said, did you dedicate them to me? Like, or do they have dedication? She said, no, okay, I have to do that.
What was it about these messages in the poems that you hope to impart with her?
The book isn't necessarily written for her. It's more like written around her. In some ways, it's a record of things that, you know, she'll be too young to even remember. Like hurricanes we went through in Florida. There's some poems about when we lived in Arkansas. In some ways, it's a record of me more than her during her young life. In a lot of ways, it probably could apply to other mothers. One message in the book is that the time, place where we are now, there are seeds of that in other times. So I have a few poems in there about the 90s. I also have a few poems in there about September 11th. I ended up thinking about both times a lot during the past few years, not the 90s in like the kind of pop culture, you know, VH1 artists of the 90s thing, but more like what was happening politically then, what was happening socially and economically then. I also have a poem about Nicole Brown Simpson and OJ. I think a lot about the effect people have on each other and also the effect on places. So I have poems about my time in Arkansas, Florida during some hurricanes, even a poem of going back to when I was in high school and I had to take a career test. Looking forward and thinking about like how inaccurate that career test was. Like, how does the past influence the future? How in the future are we able to re-see the past? Wow. It's through the limited lens. I've only had this one life that is bounded by these certain years. I can do reading outside of it, but in terms of what's written in the book, it is mostly things that I was alive for and experienced.
For those of us who do not write poetry, you know, when you write in different genres, you know what your process is. And of course, it never goes seamlessly, but you kind of know how you start and what you do when you hit a speed hump. And in writing poetry, what is your approach? I research, I decide how many stanzas. What is your map?
I collect a lot of information like when I'm not writing poetry. So a lot of things I'll write down when I'm just like watching TV at night or go down like sort of YouTube rabbit holes and do research on things. A lot of history. I get really interested in places. I click around on Wikipedia a lot. I'll just think of things that are interesting to me that I want to learn more about. I'll think, well, maybe this will be a good poem, or maybe there's something here that feels like it's a good question, like what actually is the source of inspiration? And usually it's something that's maybe troubling to me, not troubling in a bad way, but there's something I'm trying to fit together. I'm trying to get my mind around something. So I do a certain level of research, and then I kind of think, what kind of story can I attach this to? I'm not someone who writes like really impressionistic poems. I wouldn't say they're abstract at all. They're usually really concrete. One example I'll give is I was just thinking one night about how it would be nice if we had instruction manuals for kids, which I think every parent has wished for. But what if I wrote a poem in which I tried to write down baby care instructions? It started, you know, as a series of instructions, like imperative commands. And I was like, no, this doesn't feel right. So I ended up imagining a scene of me and my daughter in which we were at a swing set. I mean, it's not a literal time that happened, but I've pushed her in a swing hundreds of times and thinking about both the pleasure and danger of that moment. On one hand, I'm thinking about how precarious it is to have a kid. I have this line that says, I remember how everyone thought I'd kill you by mistake. that was kind of a thought I had as a young mom. But then I have, you know, the satisfaction of feeling like I can take care of her and I am taking care of her. It says, you made me too, daughter, drawing the last slip from a juice box, wisps of hair rising in the dirty breeze. I show you how to kick to propel yourself, and all threat dips like the sun behind the jungle gym.
Oh, so
I tried
beautiful.
To just be in that moment, you know? Mm-hmm. And then the last line harkens back to some of the maybe fear I felt that I wouldn't be a good mother. The last line is, I may have been born a knife, but my daughter won't be a knife, nor its willing sheath. So I don't want her to hurt, or I don't want her to be someone who absorbs hurt. I want her to just be her own person. Those aren't really baby care instructions, but they are in some ways intentions for her. That's just one poem. I mean, usually I try out different approaches. I do try to ground everything in scene or in some kind of story. Sometimes there'll be like a little bit of dialogue or something that I'll think of that I'll throw in there, but there's no kind of like magic bullet. I don't know. You talk to so many writers. Some people write at certain times of the day, and it has to be planned because I don't have spare time. I'll like collect ideas, and then I'll be like, all right, well, I have a block of time between 2 and 4 on Thursday. Let me see what I can get written there. Or I had my daughter even, I would always dedicate like either Saturday morning or Saturday afternoon. Now I don't do that because I have her, but that was formerly my free time. Now it's carving it out of usually the work day. I'm a professor, so I'm able to do that. Sometimes it's her playing out in the other room and I'm writing in my room. I have to be careful though, because you look up and you're like, oh my gosh, 5 hours have passed, you know? Mm-hmm. That doesn't happen that often because I don't let that happen. You're stealing time from other places in your life. That's true for people who don't have kids, I know too.
Well, but it probably makes you a better mother being able to do that, have that outlet than had
true.
You not had that outlet.
Yeah.
You also participate in something called Not Abandon But Abide, which is a series of interviews with women and genderqueer poets of the South, published by the Southern Review of Books. Can you tell us about it?
That interview series came about because I like interviewing other poets. I like talking to them about their work. I try to get my students to do it too, because I feel like kind of crazy if you just write to a poet you admire and they'll actually like talk to you about their book. It's wild. In fact, no one has ever said that I've asked that they didn't want to be interviewed. You may experience that actually yourself as an interviewer, right?
People love talking about their writing, and I love talking to people about their writing.
So this series is about women and genderqueer writers in the South. First, I was thinking people currently living in the South. And then I knew some poets who had written what I would consider Southern books that were based on having lived in the South. Mm-hmm. So I was like, okay, that I can include them. They've written Southern books. And then the women and genderqueer piece of it. I just wanted to highlight writers who are writing along some of the same subject matters I am, even though obviously we're not writing all the same things. I wanted to position gender as somewhat fluid in the title of the interview series. I didn't want to, you know, only talk to women or say someone could maybe only want to talk to men. I didn't want to do any of that. So I wanted to be able to include non-binary poets or poets who at times identify as non-binary and other times identify as women. Speaking as a parent, I know some parents like that. I feel like since we're writing in the same area of concerns, it would be interesting. I'm always interested in highlighting, I guess you could say, women or adjacent to women writing coming from those voices. I've worked for a few literary arts organizations that are specifically focused around promoting women's writing or writing that needs more attention, maybe. I wanted that to be the subject. And then Not Abandon But Abide is from a line by the poet C.D. Wright, a poet who's now deceased, but she's from Arkansas. I really, really, really love her work. Her work is very like grounded in place. So a lot of the writers I have been able to talk to write either about gender or they write work that's very grounded in place. There is some curation around who I'm going to talk to. But whenever I do the interviews, I really do like a deep reading of their books, come up with really specific questions. I was doing that interview series monthly. It's turned into a little less than that because once a month is hard to sustain. I also run an in-person reading series in Middle Tennessee in Cookeville called Sawmill Poetry. So I invite writers from across Tennessee, but also we've had poets come from Kentucky and from Alabama, Mississippi, North, I guess, all the southern states nearby. So curating that and getting those poets to come and then doing the interview series, it's hard to sustain all of that every month. But I have a few on my list to talk to soon. Before the end of the year, there should be another interview out.
What are you working on right now?
I continued working on my book pretty much up until the manuscript was due. It was accepted and then I kept making changes. And then I actually wrote another long poem that's 11 pages and I put that in. I've been working on gearing up for the promotion of the book, scheduling events, doing a mini tour and such. Yeah. I have written some other poems though. I would say that subject wise, they are about fathers and fatherhood as a concept. I've thought of that a lot because my daughter, you know, being donor conceived, it's made me think so much about what fathers are and aren't and what role they can serve or don't.
That'll inspire some interesting conversations.
I like the books to talk to each other. And I think this book, No Spare People, being that it's so focused on the mother-daughter dyad, what will that book have to say to the future book about men and about fathers? It's not about my father, though.
Interesting way to organize your collections.
I don't know if this is more true of poetry and poetry collections than it is of stories or novels. It may be folks who write novels like more like they turn the page and they're like, I'm done with that story. Let me move on to this other story. For me, and I think for other poets, it's not like that. They're grouped into projects, but they're kind of a continuum of poems.
Any advice for new writers, people just thinking about toying with poetry?
My annoying advice, which if anyone follows this advice, they will come back later and they will say, I'm glad I did it. In order to write, to read more poetry, especially because a lot of us, I mean, me in the beginning too, I had certain ideas about what a poem should be like. Did it have to be ABAB rhyme scheme? Did it have to look a certain way on the page? I get a lot of poems by new poets that don't have punctuation or that are doing maybe like something that they think poetry is supposed to do, but which isn't based in actual reading of poetry. So I would say, you know, if you want to do something like write poetry, you probably should read some poetry, not out of like, you know, eat your vegetables, but because it will inspire you and you'll start internalizing some of the rhythms and sets of images that poets use. And that'll help you develop work that's more full and more nuanced yourself in terms of who to read, because that's another question that poets might have. I mean, go to a bookstore and browse whatever poetry books they have there or look around. And if you find an author you like, look at maybe where they've been published or look at who they've read with or what other authors they're associated with. Because if you like a poet, you might like the person who was their teacher. Or you might like the person that they read with when they were in New York class. Or you might like the people who are published alongside them in another magazine. And so that's like a way of discovering more poets. This is something that blows my mind. I'll have students who are in a poetry class and they won't know what a poetry collection is. Like, oh, poetry can be published in books. And I always bring in a bunch of poetry collections for them to browse through. I also bring in a whole collection of literary magazines, because that's another thing that a lot of poets don't know. Like, they know that they like poetry where they've encountered it. Maybe they've gone to an open mic night or something. But in terms of like opportunities, where do people really read poetry or how is poetry published? That's like a big blank space. And I feel like I can help them with that for sure. Bringing in copies of literary journals, poetry collections, that's the form that right now poetry publishing takes, magazines and in poetry collections.
To learn more, visit erinhooverpoet.com. If you're enjoying The Writing Table, please consider leaving us a review. There are so many podcasts out there. Reviews help other listeners find us. Thanks so much for your support.